Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Would you please start by telling me your full name, the date, the time, and your location?
So my name is Bonakaliso Nene, but I go by the moniker Jaya, that's Gyre, Nkosi Nkonkoni. I am in Johannesburg. It is 16:14, what's that? 14 minutes past 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And is that everything? I think I got everything.
Did you say the date? I don't remember the date.
Oh yes, it's actually the 31st of March, which incidentally is Trans Visibility Day. I don't know if it's worldwide or just today in South Africa, sorry, but yay to that.
Tell me what that is.
So Trans Visibility Day is a day which we recognize and we champion the importance of trans visibility, not only in our mainstream spaces, importantly in the mainstream spaces, but also particularly in our domestic spaces and our more intimate spaces, because I believe that the forwarding of trans visibility is most important in the most intimate of settings, because that's where the sentiments that are then permeated into society and therefore constitutions and any other legislative work begins. So that's what today is about, in terms of the day itself. You know, I mean, every day. I'm so sorry about that, my brother-in-law. I'm like, no.
This is part of the real documentation of life through Zoom now.
Oh yeah. Okay, yeah, I'm back.
Perfect. And do you consent to having this interview recorded, digitally uploaded, and publicly released under Creative Commons license, attribution, non-commercial share alike?
Yes, I consent to all of that.
Would you please start by introducing yourself to anyone who might find themselves listening to this? What might you want them to understand about you and the position you're speaking from?
Well, like I said, my name is Jaya. I am a multidisciplinary artist based in South Africa with global ambitions. I specialize in music, but I also work as a writer, freelance writer, as well as dance. I'm a dancer learning to choreograph, but we're going to put that on the back burner for now, just say that I try. What else? I mean, political commentator, particularly with regards to LGBTQIA plus community. I identify as queer. I am homoromantic, and homosexual, and at this point in my life. You never know, honey. It's a spectrum. So yeah, that's about it. I think that you need to know from now. I had a my first venture into artistic expression that is rooted in queer rights and queer understanding and sweet queer theory. That's the word I'm looking for, was my debut album titled Queernomics, which was a documented audiovisual book about the contemporary experience of a Black South African male, Black queer South African male, and that has gotten to me into the positions that I live and express myself in, both out of passion and out of profession. And yeah, Jaya, Nkosi Nkonkoni, which means the gay king in my native language, isiZulu.
Well, that's lovely. Would you please start by telling me what pandemic means to you?
Ooh, child, COVID. That's what it means. It means COVID. It means shutdown. It
The
means that
sound is
the
breaking up a
world
lot.
is in need of to heal ourselves. I think a lot about the view with regards to the fact that there's a virus. Okay, is it? And now, can I continue?
So what I heard
Okay.
was, what I heard was COVID and the world being locked down.
So what I was saying is pandemic means more than that, in the sense that, like, it's not just about the virus and the fact that there are implications, health implications. I think if anything, the pandemic also exposes the social structures that are, or rather the social institutions that are, that have been found wanting in this time, and perhaps exposed a bigger pandemic of corruption amongst many a country and the state. And I feel like that pandemic is just, is a word that now means far more than just that which speaks to human biology and health and whatever the study of viruses, virology, if that's not the word, I just made it up.
I'm curious, to the extent that you're comfortable sharing, what were some of your experiences like with regard to health and healthcare infrastructure before COVID-19 hit?
Well, before COVID-19 hit, I think I had, my situation's a bit different because I was younger before COVID, obviously, because it was a few years ago. Well, it was a year but ago. And I had medical aid at the time, which was really good because I was qualified for it. But obviously, I got older. And as I got older, I couldn't afford a certain type of medical aid. And so I needed to get into a different kind of medical aid, which then, of course, wasn't as good as the previous one. So when the COVID, the pandemic hit, I was finding myself in a position where at first, not being able to access the best healthcare facilities wasn't too strenuous. Like, suddenly it was like fearful, because once COVID hits and the possibility of you getting COVID meant you're not going to the best private hospital. You potentially need to go to the nearest one that your medical aid allows. And I mean, that's such a privileged position to be in. The fact that I'm even speaking of medical aid in my country, you know, like, a lot of people don't even have that. I can afford that. Some people have hospital plans, and that's like also just like insufficient, you know? And so I'd say before COVID, it was okay. It was good. It was fine. It was adequate. Let's say that, adequate. And since then, it's adequate suddenly has dropped down a tier and is now suddenly not good enough. And this is all coming from a privileged position of being able to even have the access to some form of healthcare that at least has some semblance of privatized hospital care.
Staying in the pre-pandemic world, what was your day-to-day looking like before?
Hustle, 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 man. Oh, I used to walk the streets of Johannesburg. Of course, because I'm a musician and because I'm getting like my name out there, I used to be very epic. I used to wake up in the morning. If I had a task to do, I'd go do that task. Usually take taxis. South Africa, we have taxis, but not like an Uber taxi, like a taxi, like a minibus, which takes like a lot of us. So I take a minibus taxi and I go wherever I need to go, whether that's to do a video shoot or photo shoot, studio time, conducting different form of interviews, I guess. And I was, I guess, in a way, just before COVID hit, I had a job, and I mean, I was only working on the weekends. So that was really nice. Then I spent most of my days indoors, really. And so I ended up not leaving as much as most people would. But whenever I'd leave the house, with a very particular agenda and very particular purpose to fulfill. And so a lot of times I spent walking, like engaging with people, meeting up with people, organizing events, organizing different ways in which we can collaborate with other artists in and around Johannesburg.
And what are some of the ways that you've been having to adapt that in a post or mid-pandemic world?
Well, the adaptation has come in the fact that there's no places to go collaborate to. Like, in fact, I was actually thinking about it, like a lot of people who are getting gigs and jobs right now in the artistic field are DJs, because everybody wants to have a good time. And DJs are easy, good time. You know, you just set it up and let it go. But with performers now, firstly, like the important cog for young performers and young upcoming performers in the C underground scene, at least, were the underground event organizers who were constantly trying to put events together. All of a sudden, now they don't have the means to put anything together. And so we're finding ourselves in a position where, like, there's nowhere to go, really. Like, now it's a matter of just going, luckily I'm at a dance school. That's because I put myself in dance school. Like, you know, I need something to do in the day. I can't sit down every day in my house anymore. It's just, it's crazy, you know? And so that was my means of trying to do something. But, and so that has given me a semblance of like normality, because I take the bus and I go to school in Sunning Hill, and it's nice, and I dance all day, come back exhausted as fuck, but it's fine. It's better than being exhausted from, you know, from doing nothing, because that's the worst. But like, hey, that's so much of being tiny. That's another story for another day. But anyway, it's just been quite, it's been hard to adapt, because it's hard to find a sense of productivity and also understanding what you consider as productive, because suddenly, you know, because there has been a shortage of that economic stimulus within the industry, you can't now put your success only on how much you're going to make over the weekend from a gig or whatever, because you got to find a different way in which you can understand and quantify your growth and use that to motivate you to continue to go. So hard, but doable, but hard. Yet again, I must say, from a privileged position, I happen to live in the first suburb outside of the city. And, you know, suburbs outside of the cities are just, that's nice because it's easy access. I just take one taxi and I'm in the city, and I can walk around the city, walk around to other neighboring neighborhoods amongst the city, like rather around the city. You know, there's people who are in the outskirts of Johannesburg, who are in Soweto, which is like a township. It's fine. Yes, there are taxis as well going there, but of course, with the greater distance comes greater expenditure with regards to transport, you know, so there's that. But yeah, it's been quite a transition now, figuring out what one can do on a day-to-day basis.
I'd be interested in hearing about your initial reactions to COVID-19 in the beginning.
I mean, I always try to think about the moment I first heard about it. And I'm just like, why can't I remember? Like, but it just shows how nonchalant I was to it. Like, I remember hearing about, okay, the virus in the city called Wuhan in China, and everybody locked up. And I'm just like, okay, 3D, that's cute. Let's keep it in China. Don't get it here. And then it got here, you know, and then it got very scary, because in the numbers, particularly, of course, because of the Western world and how influenced we are by the Western world in South Africa, you start hearing particularly about the US, and the numbers were spiking, and there was all Trump denialism, you know, happening at the time. So that as well was contributing, because it's like, dude, I mean, the Americans aren't even taking it seriously. Surely there's nothing to do with this. And then the numbers spiked, and then that was scary, you know. And I think that's when it's like, I had an event I had to go to a week before we had our first lockdown, and I was totally going until like, it started getting scary. The numbers were rising worldwide. And I think it was just, or was about to be made classified as a pandemic. And then that's when I even went online and I was like, guys, sorry to all my fans, I'm not coming. Like, I ain't there, honey. I'm sorry, but there'll be another opportunity. I can't risk it, you know? And so, yeah, I think it was a matter of disbelief at first. And then when it eventually hit the country, it was all like, okay, well, we're in lockdown. And I think it really hit home when someone close to me passed from it. And then that's when you're like, oh shit, like this is real. Like this is real, real. Like people are dying for real, you know? So I'd say disbelief.
Would you be willing to say a bit more about how that reaction has changed over time?
I think it fluctuates. My reaction definitely changes, like with every season, we've had different kinds of lockdowns since we've been in the initial lockdown. And of course, we've had the first and the second wave, which has like influenced us. I think the first wave hit, and that's when I lost someone close to me. And then just before the second wave hit, like the country was opening up a bit, and I was like still very like, no, I don't play with COVID. Like, I'm not leaving my house. I don't want to be seen outside of my house. Until eventually, like, it lasted a bit longer, and like the country was open. So then I was like, okay, cool. Maybe I'm overreacting. Went back into the field. It was cool. It was fun. And then we got the second wave, and then it was like, oh shit, need to get back. So I got back, and since then, like, we've opened up again. And I think I'm as at ease as I've ever been with regards to the virus. Not because I don't fear the virus, but because I just am in desperate need to live my life. And it's so hard to be alive and not feel like you're living. And that's what it felt like. It felt like I was alive, but I wasn't living. I was literally waking up, got into, like I said, bad habits for me of smoking. And like, I just didn't want it. I don't want that perpetual sense of nothingness, you know. And so like, it's just, I think it always fluctuates, you know. And then I lost someone again close to me, like two people close to me in a matter of a week, and it hits you again. So I just think it goes on and off, really, and it depends on the day. Depends on how much the media is feeding us and what they're saying in the media, and that informs how much I feel as well, quite honestly, as well as the fact that even when I'm not entirely engaged with the media, there are friends who are. And so that news trickles to you, and you have your attitudes become informed by that, invariably by the fact that you're with people who are engaging with the media. So I'd say it's up and down.
So 2020 has been a pretty big year, with many things not limited to the pandemic. I was wondering if you'd say something about what some of the biggest issues on your mind have been over the last year.
Well, the first that comes to mind, of course, is the BLM movement, which was it just engulfed the world, really. Which is a bit, I won't lie, it's a bit infuriating for two reasons, you know. It's like a catch-22 for me. I'm happy at the fact that like there's movement and like there's great conversations that are being had and changes happening. I'm infuriated by the fact that it always has to be triggered by tragedy. Like, why does it always have to be triggered by tragedy? You know, and particularly in my country, you know, I'm in a country of predominantly black people. It's so frustrating to have a movement, or rather the plight of black people, become a conversation only when people in the diaspora are speaking up about it. Like, why do Americans have to speak about it for South Africans to suddenly pay attention to the fact that, like, oh wait, we're black too. We're also suffering from a lot of neo-apartheid, neo-colonialist, neoliberal agendas that are really not actually beneficial to the day-to-day black person. And so that in and of itself is a bit frustrating. But as a whole, the Black Lives Matter movement and the momentum that it gained in the past year was very, very encouraging. With regards to queer issues in this country, we spoke about it, I've written about it, you know, just I don't want to say they were more heightened or they were spoken about a bit more. I just think the queer community in South Africa has just become a bit more, has found a way to counter the violence that we experience by finding their own form of violence, in the sense that it's not physical, but they've been able to call people out on social media and being able to bring a sense of consequence, you know, for anti-queer or very derogatory or straight up hate speech, you know, like gays are getting people fired, people are losing their jobs, and the straights are hating it. And it's like, I mean, really, dude, what do you expect us to do? That's the least we can do, like get you fired so that you don't do this to another queer person if you have the audacity to do it online, you know? So that was very encouraging to see queer people find a way to counter the violence that we experience on the day to day in the country. However, I don't think it's enough. It never has been enough. And largely it's the gay community. I say the LGBTQIA plus for queer community, but it's largely the gay community. I feel there's lots of intersectional work that still needs to be done with regards to lesbian, trans, bisexual communities in our own community and how we engage with them and how the work we do to make sure that they are as protected as we are. Because as much as there is protection, or rather a lack, not enough protection for queer people and gay people, there's more for gay people by the virtue of the fact that they're male, first of all, than there is for a lot of other demographics within the queer demographic. So that was also a very encouraging movement that was very touching. I think those are the two that really come to mind on my end, you know, at least ones that I can speak of. The ones that another that I can speak of that I'm also an ally or am an ally to, of course, are the ramifications or rather the spreading of the attitudes that have pushed through the Me Too movement, you know, and what that has done for the feminist cause and bringing light the issues that women are facing in the world today and how they are still the same archaic things people were fighting for like 20 years ago. So not even 50 years ago, you know? And so I think that was also very, very, very encouraging, but it's just, I think more than anything, if there was a movement that is still being shunned despite all of this, is still movements that cater towards the promotion of women's rights. And I think that still needs work, but strides were taken nonetheless. And like I said, I'm an ally, so I can't really speak too much on it, but I recognize the changes and I also recognize the shortcomings and recognize the need to continue all these movements, but particularly that which pertain to women.
I'm curious, what does health mean to you?
It's a very hard question, funny enough. I think if I were to keep it basic and not think about it too much, health for me means I can wake up and I can do what I need to do, get done on that day, and I can rest and wake up and do it again. You know, I'm not one that actually is so invested in my health, which is works to my detriment a lot of the times, because I find my body always ends up saying, nah, sit down, bro, like you're tired, you know. And that's another thing I think the pandemic helped with. It's like it just showed you how much we don't take care of ourselves. It just showed me as well how much I don't take care of myself. Did I learn? I mean, I help out, but I don't know. I think it's something that I think I still take for granted. And because I just keep it at that minimal place of, okay, I can wake up and breathe and get what I need to get done, and that's enough. Perhaps I should widen the scope of that. But genuinely, honestly, health means I can wake up, get my day-to-day life done, and move on, sleep, and do it again.
What are some of the changes you think we would need to see for people to have access to that kind of health that you just described?
We need a revolution. I mean, genuinely, we need a revolution, you know, because access to health is a human right, but unfortunately, it's a right that has just been afforded to few and not the masses, you know. So, like, I think we need to, one, demonetize healthcare. That's the first thing. Like, And the people like, I mean, how can you do that? The state needs to be able to keep itself going. But it just needs to be, there's certain things that just you can't pay for, and you can't pay for education, and you shouldn't pay for education, and you shouldn't pay for your health care, because we need healthy humans and educated humans to keep building more, you know? Recently I've just been thinking, because I had a discussion with some people and they were speaking about colonialism and we're speaking about conquest and, you know, how prior to the age we live in, the age people lived in was like an age of conquest where people were taking over each other's countries and everything like that. And I was like, yeah, whatever. But I was thinking, I wonder if like maybe a century from now, maybe a little later, that they'll look back and the same way we look at conquest culture and slavery culture is the way that they'll look at us for being so complicit in capitalism, you know? Because I think at the core of it is the issue. Like the capitalist model requires commodification of everything, as simple as healthcare, you know? And I mean, I'm opening a big can of worms there, which I definitely cannot like get into in this moment. But truly, we need a revolution. We need a revolution. We need a change in ideology and a humanitarian awakening. Another one, because I think it's been a century now and all we live off is human rights. But we know now that there's certain people that can get away with not affording others the human rights that they are deserving of. And therein lies a problem. Therein lies the fundamental issue that we suffer from. We don't have access to healthcare because we don't have money to access that healthcare. To go back to my earlier example, like I had to downgrade the kind of medical aid I had because I didn't have enough money. I mean, that in itself just is indicative of it, and that's from a privileged position. So I think really that's what we need, a revolution. I want to break it down and say more practical terms, but really that's the only practical. We need radical change that de-commodifies the human experience and roots it in humanity so that we all can access the basic needs we need to keep alive and use a capitalist term to grow.
What does safety mean to you?
Safety. It's hard. It's hard to describe safety. Safety is being able to live my day-to-day life without feeling a sense of anxiety in whatever action that I take in that day. That's what safety means to me. I'm actually watching Pose for the first time. And it's a bit triggering. It's like fun because it's like, oh my God, queer people. But it's like triggering because it's like, man, like I totally get the sense of not feeling safe in this space because it's like I can feel the antagonism. I can see the eyes. I can feel the eyes. I can feel that I'm not wanted here. And it's just so scary. So safety is being able to self-express without feeling a sense of anxiety that there will be consequences that are adverse to my existence.
There's been a very narrow description of safety under COVID-19 in relationship to the virus. I'm wondering how you've been negotiating with others' needs around safety at that more micro scale.
I live in a country that actually is doing well with regards to the basics, like wearing masks. Like, I think everyone is okay with that. Like, you seldom find someone fighting the need to wear a mask. Social distancing is a bit of an issue because South Africans are just so, like, it's touchy and a bit, like, close to you. You know, I had one occasion in which I asked a male to step aside to give me some space to social distance, and he was very antagonized by that, and he was just completely aggressive towards me. But that had also a lot of, you know, homophobic undertones. You could sense it in the way that he spoke and the words that he said to me. So I think that's also, that's been hard about it, if I were to put it in the lens of myself as a queer person, that whenever I feel like enforcing the safety guidelines to a person who is adverse to them, I get a very two-pronged, like, means of a response from them, which is not only a, you can't tell me what to do, it's, you can't tell me what to do, you gay man, you know? And so that's been, I think that's been the hardest part of it all. Otherwise, I think in the small ways of it all, it's been more doable. But it's also harder when you're at, like, events, because, like, I mean, South Africans, like, we party in a different way, and, like, there it's different, and you're just like, oof. I felt social pressure where I've had a mask on in a space where everyone didn't have their mask on, and the first time someone was like, take off that mask, and I was like, okay. And then someone was like, don't fall for that, like, social pressure. So then someone said, take off the mask, and I said, no, I won't. And then I didn't. And then, like, a few minutes later, I was like, I'm really feeling the social pressure right now, because, like, I feel stupid. And I took off the mask, you know. So it's been hard to deal with, but it's been doable, but it's been hard. It's just also, like, what do you quantify as safe sometimes outside of what I just spoke about? You know, well, I mean, actually, in the lens of what I spoke about, I figured out that I have an anxiety, had an anxiety about life and death itself, because then everywhere I was thinking, oh my God, I'm going to get the virus this way. Oh my God, that person in the taxi just sneezed. Why did you sneeze, bro? Like, could have, like, fought it. You know, so there is that anxiety that I speak of, living my day-to-day life without feeling a sense of anxiety. So that's also been hard, because you can't micromanage everyone. And all you can do is do the best for yourself.
I wanted to follow up on something you had said earlier, which is, how has your relationship to touch changed over the course of the pandemic?
How personal can I get?
As personal as you're comfortable with.
Okay, I'm a pretty open book, so funny. It's a funny story. I tell everyone this, not everyone, but I don't mind telling the story. So I had my first hookup, like, in November. That's the first hookup of the year. Oh, it was an anxious experience, because, like, I remember I met up with this guy, we met online, and we're talking, right, and was socially distanced, and, like, it's cool. We're talking, and I'm just like, oh, my God, okay, I don't know what to do about this situation. And then I think it's now time, like, I was feeling it, but I wasn't really feeling it. I was like, ugh, whatever, man, I could move on. But he, unbeknownst to me, because he didn't look it, was actually really feeling it. And so he stepped out for a second, and as I was grabbing my things about to go, he gives me the longest hug, and I'm like, oh, my God, I haven't felt someone so close to me in such a long time. But that's, like, okay, it's just a hug. You're not going to die from COVID. Then he leans over to kiss me, and I'm just like, oh, my God, it's the virus. And then, like, he kissed me for, like, the first 30 seconds, and then he stepped outside to go check something else again, and I was losing my shit. I was like, oh, my God, I need to brush my teeth. Oh, my God, oh, my God, I need to take a shower. Something needs to happen. And then he came back, and then I was like, okay, just relax, dude. Like, this is normal. It's okay. You're not going to die. And then the rest is too, it's R-rated. I'm not going to get into that. But I just thought, like, that moment was so funny, because, like, it just showed me how much I, like, how anxious I'd become to, like, the idea of being touched and being intimate with anyone. You know, like, I think touching, physical touching, like, I never really got too close to anyone to be able to, because, like I said, I took a very long time to get back into, like, life and doing day-to-day things anyway. So I was hardly in contact with people. So when I was, it was like, okay. But that was like the first time I really got into contact with someone, like up close and goddamn personal. And it was very, initially very uncomfortable. And like, I think I peer pressured myself into the whole engagement because I was just like, ah, dude, like really? 2020 is going to go by and nothing. I'm like, no, girl, do it. You can do it. Oh, God. And yeah, it was a bit of a moment when I told my friends about it. So I'm like, the virus. I'm like, relax. God's on my side. Surely God understands my human needs. So that was pretty interesting. Other than that, I also found it hard because, like, I'm a very affectionate person as well, generally, and I don't mind anything, but like, some people just like didn't understand that like now it's COVID, so you can't actually do that. So I suffered a lot from social pressure yet again, from not handshakes, but hugs. People want to hug you and just be like, no, like also recently I was out from a performance and someone obviously recognized me, someone who's a supporter of my work, and they were so excited and like not in a romantic way or anything, but they just wanted to kiss me. And I was like, oh, hey, hi. And they're like, and I'm like, no, my God. And then I was like, ah, the virus. So more than anything, it's just like, it's so hard to be able to stand your ground sometimes with people who are more blasé with the idea of touch. Other than that, like, I mean, I've always just kept my boundaries. Like, no one touches me inappropriately, generally. So that was, like, whatever. But, like, I do think those particular two examples, particularly the first, speak to how my relationship to touch has changed. Like, it was, like, such a sensational moment. Like, not in, like, sexual way, but, like, it was just, like, the sensation felt so new to me to have someone so close that it was like, okay, I definitely understand that I definitely don't need to do this, like, not even every month. I haven't hooked up with it, no, I have not, actually. I don't mind, though, because it's like my relationship with touch has really changed. Like, I'm really, like, on some, you know what, let's socially distance, let's do that, you know? So, yeah, my relationship has changed drastically.
How are you feeling about the immediate future?
It's hard not to think about it from the point of view where I am at right now because I've had a shitty 2 days. But I think that's part and parcel of just like life. You have some pretty shitty days. But I'm optimistic. I'm very optimistic about the near future because I think outside of the health things that have happened because of COVID, like I said, many things have come to light as a result of the pandemic in terms of like social movements, in terms of like social needs as well and opportunities as well. Like I always say to people that like COVID has been the biggest reset button there's been in a minute, you know, and you can just start again and figure things out. And so I'm excited because we're literally walking into a new world now, a completely new world. Like you feel it in the air, you see it in how people engage and how you engage as an individual to the world around you. And I think that has been very, for me, encouraging. I like change. That all the time, then change happens and I'm like, but I like change. I really like change. I hate still things. I hate not being able to. I'm an Aquarius, I'm an air sign. I like to flow with the air. So I'm optimistic about the near future. I'm optimistic.
What are some of your hopes for the more long-term future?
My hopes for the long-term future are that we as a race, human race, decisive in the things that we undertake. Because I think that's what COVID has also shown us. When you half-heartedly do things, you get half-hearted results. like the universe doesn't give you 10 out of 10 for a 2 out of 10 commitment to a task, you know? So I'm hoping that in the long-term future, that when we say that we are working towards getting better rights for women, queer people, Black people, and other minority groups, we are doing it and not just saying it, because karma will bite our butts if we don't, because the universe will put us in a position where we have no choice but to confront all these issues. And I think if we haven't taken that out of this whole situation yet, then I think we have not learned from this. And God knows how many waves. I believe when you don't learn a lesson, you will experience it a billion times. And if the human race and we, the people of this time, have not learned that lesson, I fear that COVID is just the start of a barrage of tragedies, all in the hope of teaching us true humanity.
What are some of the ways that you've been taking care of yourself over the last year?
I think I've taken more care of my mental health. Still suck at it, but I've recognized the importance. I've also truly recognized the importance of rest. You know, yet again, this capitalist world we live in just doesn't allow you to rest. It just wants you to keep at it. But like, I've learned the value of rest. And I think that's probably the best way I can take care of myself, because that's the one thing I probably wasn't doing enough of pre-pandemic. Like, I was just always on a roll, always busy with something. I mean, till this day, my mother's always tells me, you're always busy with something. What are you even doing? And it's like, oh, what am I even doing? That's a good question. You know, I've always got an answer, of course. I can't tell you mother you're doing nothing, because we never hear the end of that. But rest is important. I've learned that rest is important. I need to see a therapist. I just need to find out what my medical aid allows me to get in terms of cleaning up my mental health or whatever my name. So brain, clean up my brain. and the importance of that and the necessity that has actually over my productivity, not only for the sake of the external things I need to get done, but as well for my spiritual wealth, for my mental wealth, and for my love of self, really. So, yeah.
I'm at the penultimate question. So we know we're in this moment of a flurry of biomedical and scientific research. I'm wondering what you think people in the humanities and the social sciences could be doing to help us understand this moment.
I think perhaps they need to learn to not speak above us and speak to us. Learn how to speak in lay. Like, how do you tell the layperson what's happening and the importance of what's happening? The same way I think climate change activists, I think they need to do more, in this country at least, to explain to the layperson what's going on to our planet, you know, because I think these terms are fancy, but they're like, they stay and they're built for academic discourse, whereas the work needs to be done on the ground, you know. And so I think they need to learn to, or rather, not even learn, they must quickly apply, learn the job, how to speak to the lay person about what's happening, the importance of what's happening, the decisions they're taking, why they're making those decisions, the rationale of those decisions to the day-to-day person, because then that gives perspective and gives them time as well to fully develop things without the pressure. Like, it's like if they knew how to explain how we get a vaccine, maybe people wouldn't be so panicked and rushed to get a vaccine, you know. or rather, and make many, so many mistakes about vaccine rollouts. How do those work? You know, I think if they'd be able to communicate to people on a very like basic human level, they'd be able to give themselves time to do their work without the pressure and without unnecessary or uneducated views being filtered or manipulated by either states or partisan desires within the political realm. And so that's what I think. Does that make sense?
It does, yes. So this is my last question. This is an oral history interview, and I come to that with some assumptions as a historian. And one of them is that historians of my moment are taught to pay very dedicated attention to what our historical actors thought was important at the time. So what they deemed as important really matters to us. I'm wondering if you could speak to historians of the future, what kinds of stories would you tell them not to forget?
Ooh. Simple, actually. Do not forget the story of queer, black, differently able.